even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hi, this is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
This is Yannick Noah.
Hi, this is James Meredith from London, England, and you're listening to my favourite podcast. It's the Tennis Podcast.
Well, hello and thank you to James Meredith there, of whom we are the favourite podcast, lovely James. He was a backer in last year's Kickstarter. In fact, he backed at private podcast level. So he received a private tennis podcast with the three of us, the contents of which you'll never know about. He's also backed us this year. He's going to be a guest editor. Which is sure to carry bags of fun. It's going very well, our Kickstarter, which is the understatement of the century. I don't know how to do this bit without sounding fantastically smug and gloaty, because we are just completely overwhelmed. I know we say this every year, but we've sort of redefined overwhelmed in terms of our reaction this year. Our whole kind of reaction to the Kickstarter, which launched less than 48 hours ago as we record this at 2:40 p.m. on Thursday, has been the equivalent to the way Matt was looking at the screen on day 2 of the Australian Open last year, when there were more matches than have ever been played in the history of tennis in one day. And he was so excited, but he couldn't cope with it all, and his poor little face was just all too much. And that's exactly the state that we've all been in for the past 46 hours and 40 minutes, because as we come to you, we are 95% funded for 2021, and there's still 49 days of the Kickstarter to go, during which we'll still be trying to persuade you to back us and take up the remaining categories and rewards that we have available. I think we've got about 25 predictions slots still available. We've got private podcast slots available, some guest editorships, lots and lots of shout outs or name dissections, as they're now being referred to, and intros as well. So if you'd like to have your name in our intro, like lovely James Meredith today, then you can still do all of that. All of our mascot slots have gone, David, all sort of 400 of them that I engineered.
I mean, that was hilarious. On Tuesday night when we launched this thing, by the time we went to bed, 39 out of the 40 weekly mascots had gone. And then just as I'm about to put my pyjamas and my nightcap on,
really, the 40th really one hope went. That's a metaphor.
Yeah, it is.
yeah, they've all gone. The people love pets. And tennis. I mean, I don't know why we bother with the tennis on this tennis podcast anymore. It's clear that the people demand pets.
I quite like tennis.
Yeah. It's all right. It's all right. But honestly, I'm struggling for the words, really, for what this support means to us. I mean, obviously, primarily it means that we'll be able to carry on doing this and pouring all the energy and love that we have into it this year and even more. But even on top of that, it just it's emotionally quite overwhelming, the support that we've received, not just financially, but the messages that have accompanied it. They all mean something to us, so thank you so much. If you'd like to chip in or get one of the rewards categories, then please do. every penny that goes into that Kickstarter, even if it's beyond the target, will be used wisely. I promise you that it'll be used to make this podcast as good as it can possibly be. So thank you. And let's relive more of this horrible year.
Awesome. people will be unbacking us.
Yeah. Now that you've given us your money, let's remind you what an awful year it's been. When we left you last time, we had just relived the Adria tour. What a time that was. And briefly touched upon the Ultimate Tennis Showdown, which was not ultimate, not tennis, and certainly not a showdown. So we pick up now with tennis relived, and tennis relived for the Olympics, which should have been in Tokyo 2020. This wasn't in our first slate of planned relived shows, and I said, oh, we should do an Olympics relived show. And then suddenly we did six Olympic relived shows in the end, or maybe five, yeah. But one of them was 2 hours long, so basically it was six shows.
I think it was seven.
I mean, yes, great.
I've just counted Olympics, and I've got to, I think we did two in one show, and then we did six separate shows. Yeah, wow. So seven altogether.
Seven.
I've just counted it on my fingers. I mean, that is terrible. My son is currently doing his times tables, and he's the speed with which he can do them, and here I am counting to eight on my fingers.
Yeah, so we basically did a show Paralympics, didn't we, in the end? No, a show for, yes, did we do a show Paralympics? Yeah, it's just the first one where we covered two Olympics, and it was sort of 14 hours long. I don't know how many of you listening actually made it to the end of that first Olympics relived show, but it was very good. I enjoyed it very much. This is the
go and relive it.
Well, this is the portion of the show that I'm going to find it hard not to be biased about, because obviously the Olympics lights a fire inside me, and I particularly enjoyed sort of an aspect of it which I wasn't quite expecting, which was the getting to hear about the various levels of joy at winning medals and how they don't correspond in any way with the colour of that medal necessarily. Yeah, that was one of the most interesting sort of thought experiments. Well, not thought experiments, I mean actual experiments. People have lived them, and we spoke to them, but that was a fascinating element of it, wasn't it?
Yeah, I sort of had some insight ahead of time into what to expect from certain people, but others, I knew nothing of their stories, or I just knew that they'd won a medal, or I just knew that they'd missed out. I mean, it was James Blake who just missed out, wasn't it? And we had him on, and I kind of knew what his general feelings were, but so many of the other stories I really didn't know about until we actually got to speak to them, and that was a real joy to me, especially having seen them all on TV from afar and always wondered.
Mm. Everyone's got their own Olympic story, I think, an Olympic connection, which we discovered along the way. And I think that's why we ended up reflecting on tennis's own place in the Olympics. And that is such a difficult question to actually answer, because it is kind of individual for so many people. But what we did find is that everyone who had certainly won gold cherished that medal as pretty much dearly as anything that they've won in the sport. And there were also, as we will hear, especially one person who won bronze and will cherish that more than probably anything in their life ever. So there were just these discrepancies in people's own connection to the games. And that was, yeah, that was kind of the most enlightening part of it, I think.
Mm. Well, let's hear from the man that you referred to there, Leander Paes, and also from Marty Fish. Marty Fish got a silver medal, Leander Paes a bronze, and we'll also hear first from Gigi Fernandez, who actually won two gold medals. And yeah, that difference of experience and joy levels, I think this compilation of clips illustrates that perfectly. Gigi Fernandez talking first about being, as she views it, the first Puerto Rican to win a gold medal, obviously something that Monica Puig achieved when she won in Rio in 2016 and was lauded as the first Puerto Rican to win gold. But Gigi Fernandez believes that that title really belongs to her.
Well, I was very proud that Monica won a gold medal. I was very happy that a Puerto Rican stood on the podium and the national the La Borinquena played. But there's no question that I am the first Puerto Rican to win a gold medal. I am Puerto Rican. I'm as Puerto Rican as they come. It's a very controversial subject, you know. But, I mean, I was born and raised there. I developed my tennis there. I didn't leave there till I went to college. I just won it for the U.S. So, I mean, I think the correct way to say it is, like, Monica Puig is the first Puerto Rican to win a gold medal representing Puerto Rico, and I'm the first Puerto Rican to win a gold medal.
Was there any sort of emotional conflict for you when you were on the podium not hearing the Puerto Rican anthem?
Absolutely. Mm. I mean, it's like I have both passions, because all Puerto Ricans are U.S. citizens. I had a Puerto Rican flag that I pulled out, so I had the Puerto Rican flag and the American flag. And I think it's fairly unique in this. Well, you guys have some of that because you guys have, you know, Irish and Scottish.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah.
And you all, so you can kind of understand that kind of confusion of what you are.
And you can be more than one thing.
Correct.
Just not at the Olympics.
Right. Well, I mean, I still feel like I'm a Puerto Rican representing the United States. I always felt that, you know, it's, the world is a melting pot. Especially more so now, right?
Absolutely. I read a lot about sort of your childhood and so on, what you had to sacrifice and risk to become a tennis player. Did winning gold at the Olympics, did that feel like a kind of a validation of all of that and all of those decisions?
Yeah. It's funny because, like, when I was growing up, it was not a goal of mine because it was not an option. So I think winning Grand Slams was more of a validation of, like, that it kind of all paid off. And also this decision to represent the United States has continued to haunt me over the last 25 years. It's still very controversial in Puerto Rico, and it just doesn't seem to end, especially after Monica won the gold medal. It was really hard, like, a couple of years ago after she won the gold medal, because everybody was like, well, if she did it, you could have done it. And I was like, well, but I didn't play singles. So, it's like the story that never ends, you know. And then I'm sure it'll come back again when she goes to defend. And
that's really tough.
Yeah, it's very, very complicated. Mm. And people still talk about it. I mean, if I go on social media, sometimes I go through pages of being on social media and not being on social media because people get so – they're so vindictive, you know, and so it's like harassment on social media. Like, I mean, I'll just write a post, like a random post about my kids or whatever, and then somebody will comment, yeah, but Monica was the first Puerto Rican to win a gold medal. Like, completely unrelated. This is 3 years later. And it's like, oh my God, people just will not let it go. I mean, I do appreciate the fact that I am an Olympic, two-time Olympic gold medalist, and I think in general, people respect that and know that it was a good accomplishment, especially to defend, because not a lot of people have defended in tennis. So do you think I'm the first Puerto Rican to win a gold medal?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, okay, good. Good answer. Good answer.
Well, you're a Puerto Rican and you won a gold medal. So
thank you.
Those are the facts, right? Where's the balance between happiness at winning an Olympic medal and disappointment at it not being the gold?
It's tough to find, to be honest. In the moment, I sort of felt like, okay, you know, I'm really really bummed right now, but in time, it'll be really amazing to bring this medal back and sort of share it with my family and friends. And that never really happened. I never really felt like, okay, let me show this thing off. Let me show my second place off. And it just didn't feel right. I sort of even felt like third, you know, like bronze medal, at least you win that match. Fernando Gonzalez beat Taylor Dent in that third and fourth playoff. And Fernando won his match to win his medal. I lost my match to get my medal. So it felt odd. The other thing too is that people maybe not understand is that they give you an Olympic ring, regardless of if you're an Olympic athlete, and you can put a one diamond in there for an extra $200 or whatever. But they put your sport and they put your name on it, and if you're lucky enough to win a medal, they'll put what you won on there, and they send it to you after the fact, obviously. And so I got my ring in the mail, and it said gold medalist on it. And I initially was like, oh, wow, this is pretty cool. I got a gold medal ring, you know, and I put it on. I'll never forget this. I put it on one time. I went to the supermarket just to get, you know, something and some groceries for the house, and had it on. And I remember checking out, and I looked down at it, and I'm like, what are you doing wearing this thing? Like, you are not a gold medalist. Why are you wearing this? And I never put it on again. I actually don't know where it is anymore.
Do you remember how you felt on the podium?
I do. Yeah, I do. I was, the pictures say it all, because I've seen the pictures before a few times. Sort of devastated is an understatement. They threw up the song right after We Are the Champions, the Queen, for Nicholas. And I'll never forget that. It's one of my least favorite songs now, and I used to like the song. Look, it was some of my greatest memories of my life on the tennis court, and in turn some of my worst memories on the tennis court, all in one event.
It's the only time I skipped Wimbledon to go and play and prepare for Atlanta. When most people are surprised that I won a medal in Atlanta, my team was not, because they know how much hard work and effort I had silently focused into performing in singles in Atlanta. The funny part is, when I actually got to Atlanta and after the opening ceremony on the Saturday before the tournament started and the draw came out, I was drawn to play Pete Sampras. And the whole Indian contingent and my team looked at me, and my captain actually, Jaideep Mukherjee at the time, he tapped me on the back when we all saw the draw, and he said, "Tough luck, son. You're going to have to prepare one more time." And I smiled at him, as I gently do when people give me a no. I've had no's my whole life, mate. I've had 100 doctors tell me I would never be an athlete because I have a heart disease as a young boy. So my whole life, mate, I've had people tell me no, 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 no. I actually love it. I love it when someone tells me no. So when I saw that draw and my captain kind of instigated me by tapping me on the back, I just felt that there was some magic there. And Sampras didn't play that Olympics for some personal reasons of clothing branding or something like that. And Richie Renneberg came in. I beat Richie Renneberg because he defaulted in the third set because he could not handle the altitude conditions. And after I won that first round, something told me that the hard work was going to pay off. Just look at the karmic journey there, right? You're drawn to play Pete Sampras. You take 4 years to work your tail off to prepare for this. Pete Sampras pulls out of the draw. Richie Renneberg comes in. You work hard, 6-7, 7-6, 2-1 upper break. He retires. Then you beat Nicolas Pereira, who was number one in the world in the juniors in 1989, the year before I was. Then you beat in the third round Thomas Enqvist, who was number one in the world in the juniors in 1991, the year after I was. Then you come up against Lorenzo Furlan and beat him on pure serve and volley tennis, 6-2, 7-5. And then you play the mighty Andre Agassi, one of my best friends on tour. And both of us have an uncanny history with the Olympics because his father was a boxer for Iran, if I'm not mistaken, back then. And my dad was an Olympic champion in field hockey in 72 in Munich. And we played each other, and I had two set points against him in the semis. And he hit a passing shot at 5-6, 15-40 in the first set at my face. And I had to hit the volley in an awkward position. My right wrist was in a vulnerable position, and he ruptured tendons in my wrist. And the Dougie Spreen, the tournament physiotherapist, came on, and he said, "Lee, you've got ruptured tendons in your wrist. You need to stop. You're going to jeopardize the rest of your career." And I basically turned to him in the heat of the moment, as crazy as we athletes are, and said to him, "Strap me up and let me back out. This is my chance to win an Olympic medal." Well, I didn't get the chance that afternoon because Agassi saved the second set point and won the tiebreak in the first set, 7-6, and then beat me, I think, 6-3 in the second. I was playing with that ruptured wrist tendons. And then I had to go into a hard cast for 24 hours because there was a break between the semifinals and the bronze medal match. And with that ruptured wrist, I had to come out and play one of my best friends from Brazil, Fernando Melangeni. After losing the first set, I just found, it was just mind over matter, you know, that day. I just found a mental space somewhere deep inside me. And when that last ball flew over my head beyond the baseline, I had my hands up in the air and most people thought it was in jubilation, but it was just in relief of literally 20 hard years of a lot of effort, a lot of sacrifice, a lot of single-minded focus to eventually emulate my father and win a medal for 1.3 billion Indians.
That's a really extraordinary tale of, as you said, this sense that there was something in the air and there was a sense of destiny and a journey behind it. Where does it rank in your career, that bronze medal at the 96 Olympics? I noticed that it's your background picture on your Twitter account. Number one, you say?
Number one, because my second rank of anything that's happened in my career is the fact that my parents conceived me in 72 in Munich. And that was during the 4 days that the Munich Olympics were shut down because the Palestinian-Israeli troubles. I guess my parents had nothing else better to do. So I was born on June 17th, 1973. So I was an Olympic baby. So what better than to go and win an Olympic medal, right? It just justifies the reason you're born.
There is never a bad time to relive the conversation where Matt discovers when and where Leander Paes was conceived. Thank goodness that wasn't his Twitter background.
Yeah, when I hear that back, I think, what a stupid question asking him where that ranks. Obviously, it's number one.
But yeah, but you need to get the quote, don't you? You need to get him saying it. Mm-hmm. And boy, did you get the quote.
It was just one after another quote. So yeah. Leander Paes, I mean, he is an incredible storyteller. And actually, those three stories back to back, I'd forgotten them. Matt cut those clips for us today, and we've just heard them for the first time since we recorded those shows a number of months ago. And it shows the power of them because they got me smiling. They got me feeling sad for Gigi Fernandez when she's saying to you, do you think I'm the first Puerto Rican to win a gold medalist? And I thought, you know, that's really something that she's just wrestling with this all these years on.
Mm. I've thought about that a lot because why should she care what I think? Why should she care whether I think she's, you know, I've never met her. You know, we had one, it was a really great Zoom conversation, fantastic interview, but it, you know, it clearly matters to her that people think of her in the right way as a Puerto Rican that won a gold medal proudly for her country. And the fact that she receives this online abuse and everything, it's, you know, very understandably not something she's able to detach herself from. And that makes me really sad, as did pretty much the whole conversation with Mardy Fish. I mean, you'd certainly take Leander Paes' bronze over Mardy Fish's silver, wouldn't you? And for anybody that still hasn't seen those pictures of Mardy Fish on the podium, I mean, first of all, gird your loins and then take a look because they, as he said himself, they tell the whole story of how he was feeling. And I get it, you know, as much as I covet an Olympic medal, hopelessly, I can sympathise with that being the feeling, particularly in tennis, of being on the podium in second place. And he illustrated it so well with that story of always thinking he'd want to show off his medal, and then actually when it comes to it, feeling like, oh, you're just going around saying, here's something I came second at.
That dynamic is not unique to tennis. There are other sports which have a kind of third, fourth place playoff for a medal, but it's a very interesting thing, because Mardy Fish also said in that interview, which we didn't play in that clip, but he said he was so relieved to have won his semi-final match because it meant it guaranteed him a medal. So he thought he was going to be happy whatever happened, because he was terrified of finishing fourth. He said he'd rather have lost in the first round than finish fourth. So both those matches over the weekend, where you've got the gold medal playoff and the bronze medal playoff, those are such tough matches to lose, because you're either so close to a gold medal or you finished without a medal, and you might as well have gone out in the first round if you look at it just in those terms. So I think we found that weekend in tennis is a minefield of emotions for players as they try and grapple with which medal they're going to end up with, and your outlook on whether you're having a good games or whether you're going to end up feeling positive after the games can change so suddenly just based on the one match.
And just to round off the Olympics Relived portion of this show, since doing those Olympics Relived shows, so much of them stayed with me and really got me thinking. I've whilst being in the company of Tim Henman and Greg Rozedsky, as I have been a fair bit over the past few weeks and months, I've quizzed them a bit about the Olympics. I've pressed them on whether they have any regrets, and I don't want to put words in their mouth, because, you know, it's A, sort of off the record, and B, didn't get their definitive views on it. But I certainly got the impression that were it now, they would absolutely make different choices about playing the Olympics and where they would rank it in terms of commitment. And I do get the feeling the Sydney Olympics, for both of them, actually, they feel like is the one that got away. I think because of its positioning in the calendar, unusually it was after the US Open, whereas it would usually be prior to the US Open. But because Sydney's in the Southern Hemisphere, they needed to play it later. They needed to stage it later in the year. You know, I was sort of jokingly teasing them both on why on earth they didn't play doubles together at that Olympics. And, you know, I don't think either of them are lying awake at night thinking, why didn't I commit to those Olympics? But, you know, Greg didn't even play. And I think Tim did play, but lost early. And I don't know. I think both those two are good examples, because I think they're players that completely maximised. I don't think they have regrets about their careers that keep them up at night. But I managed to elicit just a little hint of wistfulness from them when asking them about the Olympics. So, yeah.
Mm. And doesn't that show the arc of the Olympics that we kind of discovered? I think there are so few players now who need to be convinced about playing the Olympics. And I think one of the last ones was Dominic Thiem. And actually, since we've done those Olympic Relived shows, he has confirmed he's going to be playing in the Olympics next year if it happens.
I mean, he's asked to borrow Catherine's box sets.
Yeah, he definitely listened to Olympics Relived and caught the bug. That's definitely what happened. Yeah, he was the last bastion, wasn't he, of Olympics denial. Mm. And he's fallen, which is brilliant. So fingers, toes, everything crossed that we do get the Tokyo Olympics in 2021. Obviously, our relived tennis relived for 2020, at least, it will be returning for 2021, ended with our two pre-US Open shows, focusing on the lives and stories of Arthur Ashe and Althea Gibson. And boy, are those two shows kind of difficult to sum up in a sort of pithy way. Somebody help me.
Well, they're the ones that I think probably mean the most to me of all the near 150 that we've done this year. And I'm very proud of a lot of the shows that we've done for various reasons over the course of the year, and I've enjoyed them all immensely. I didn't enjoy every aspect of putting together those two shows, because I found some of the material quite upsetting and difficult to just stomach, that the worlds that particularly Althea Gibson was part of, and the struggles that she had, and also Arthur Ashe as well. You know, I But at the same time, they felt more important than anything else that we've done, really. They educated me all the way through. I knew bits and bobs, but I didn't know half or even a fraction of the things that we ended up discovering, and all the stories that contributors in those shows told us. People like Leslie Allen, who I knew very little about before you spoke to her for that show. I mean, I still think about things she says, and I haven't listened to the show for a good few months, you know, but I want to go back and listen to it. They're the highlights of the year for me.
Mm. That Leslie Allen interview was probably the best interview I've ever done, and none of that is to do with me. There was one line from it that, I mean, so much of it has stuck with me, but one moment in it keeps playing on my mind, which is when she was talking about draw fixing. She certainly didn't talk about tour level or Grand Slam level or anything like that. When she was talking about it in the past, she was talking about, you know, lower level tournaments and junior tournaments and that sort of thing. But it happening anywhere, frankly. You know, I like to think of myself as pretty progressive and liberal and woke. You know, I'm very aware of my white privilege. I'm not kidding myself. I don't have a lot to learn, but I felt so sheltered and naive when I asked that question about draw fixing and heard her response. You know, of course it happened, and she didn't want to overstep and say, I know that it still happens now, because she couldn't provide evidence of that, but she suspected it still happens now. And that blew my mind, kind of. And the fact that it blew my mind is an indication of, yeah, of my shelteredness and privilege. To think that we live in a world where people likely are still fixing draws in certain corners of it to ensure that what black players are allowed to enter are minimised in the later rounds is so horrifying and so eye-opening.
That whole Leslie Allen interview has stuck with me, and I think the way she brought those historical stories into the present day and really reflected on their relevance now was the thing. And, you know, these aren't stories of the past. These are ongoing issues that we need to engage with and learn from and be better at. And I think it sort of led into the summer that we had with Naomi Osaka and Coco Gauff doing what they did, and just felt like those were the shows where, you know, we like to see the funny side of tennis and have a laugh about the sport, but those were very serious shows, and they were ones where I thought we really owed it to the listeners and to those stories to get them right and to really research them. And, you know, that was rewarding for us as well. And we learned a lot. And, you know, I just hope we did do those stories and people justice, really. Mm.
By that point, of course, when we were recording those shows, tennis had returned. I think for the sort of 5-6 months that tennis was away, we'd all sort of pictured this glorious celebratory moment of tennis's return, where it would be everything that we've missed all piled into one moment: enormous crowds, jubilation, biggest players in the world. It was in Palermo. I'm not saying Palermo isn't really, really nice, and that's not a good tournament, but it was quite a low-level WTA event with an okay field and no crowds. And it was, you know, it was a shuddering moment of being dropped into the cold water of new reality.
Yeah. I think the other thing is that so much of the talk during the lockdown period was about tennis being more united than ever, and the return to tennis was this really disjointed, kind of shuddery, slightly low-key affair. And I understand why that was. Tennis has very difficult challenges in terms of putting on these events during a pandemic. But it was a reminder that as much as there was talk of merger and unity during the lockdown, there's still kind of quite a long way to go to actually reach that. And yeah, it was quite a sobering reminder of the current state of tennis and also the current state of the world and how tennis fits into it. And yeah, it definitely wasn't the utopian, idealistic, big celebration that we were all hoping
for. That's still coming, Matt. It's still coming sometime.
But it was where we discovered Fiona Ferro, Matt.
Well, I was aware of Fiona Ferro,
right.
David.
It's where I discovered Fiona Ferro. and realized how good she was. But yeah, I mean, you're right, it was a small event. I mean, they did a good job to put it on, and I think they might have had a few spectators.
They did have a sprinkling, but it was very
quiet, wasn't it? It was very low-key, and as you say, just you build it up, and they did the best that they could. But yes, it was kind of fitting, really, with the rest of the year.
Yeah, and the theme of 2020 is, you know, making the most and being grateful for what you've got. Here we are doing exactly that back in August.
It does feel properly like real tennis now, because this is the first time we've reviewed a tennis tournament and previewed another one with pre-tournament press conferences going on everywhere that we've been able to listen across to and chat amongst ourselves about people and look at draws. I mean, actually looking at draws is suddenly such a thrill. It feels so exotic.
One of my lockdown tasks was to organise my phone apps into really helpful folders. And I completely forgot which folder I put my ATP WTA scores app in. It took me quite a long time to hunt around to find that.
Mine seemed to shut itself down, given that it hadn't been used for 5 months. I had to reload it onto my phone.
Just a bit of rust. Mm. It was glorious to see tournaments pop up in it, though, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. That's such a defining feature of tennis happening, the ATP WTA app being full. I've kind of forgotten how to preview tennis.
Great. Stay tuned, folks.
Because the WTA always send out, prior to every tournament, they send out, you know, match notes, really helpful stuff and stats. And it kind of all feels quite irrelevant at the moment because, you know, it doesn't really matter who's won the most titles this year already. There's no such thing as form at the moment. And it's all really unknown. Like, what are the factors going to be with how players perform?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Fiona Ferro is going to be like the new sort of de facto world number one.
Yeah, suddenly she feels like the greatest player of all time to me because she's 6-2-3 all against Annette Contaveit. And I did find myself looking up Fiona Ferro before this podcast to work out what she'd done before it, to see if there was any sign of this having, you know, coming about 6 months ago.
Matt thinks so.
I mean, I've gone through her exhibition results. She's unbeaten.
No, you haven't.
She's unbeaten in exhibition tennis. During the lockdown, she won 10 matches.
What exhibition tennis has she been playing?
She won 10 matches arranged by the FFT. Yeah, she played and won them all, and she's carried this form into Palermo. I mean, I'm getting carried away with, you know, for form.
Well, exactly. So maybe we should be looking at the players who have played a lot of exhibition tennis in this period. You know, for people that are shortly going to be having to make predictions, maybe that's something to a life raft to cling to.
Well, have already made predictions and they've gone incredibly badly.
But they became irrelevant very, very quickly.
It is going to be interesting, though, isn't it, to chart the few players that have played a lot of matches over the last... And there are quite a few players, because if you think of all the exhibitions that have gone around on all around the world, and some of them have been publicised, some of them have been televised, some of them we've talked about, others have kind of gone by without really being noticed, but a lot of players have played a lot of tennis and then some have hardly played any at all, and it just will be interesting to see whether that has any impact at all.
Yeah, and in terms of the tennis that's upcoming next week, we've got two events on the WTA Tour. We've got the clay court event in Prague, and then we've got this brand new event in Lexington, Kentucky, which is the first WTA event in the United States since last year's US Open. So yeah, there's a real smattering, a real mixture in both those draws of players that it feels like we've seen a lot of and heard a lot from during this lockdown period, and players that it feels like kind of disappeared off the face of the planet and you sort of vaguely forgot they existed.
Yes, it's a little bit like picking up a book that you were reading 9 months ago and you're having to sort of re-familiarise yourself with the plot and the characters. Who's this again? What do they do? Except the difference is a book doesn't change when you pick it up from 9 months. Everything's the same. I feel like this, you know, the 5 month break we've had will be having an impact on results. So it's just really difficult to tell. And I feel like no results at all are going to really be that surprising. I think if the top players do well, you can put that down to, oh, they're the better players. Of course they're going to do well. If they don't do so well, oh, this is a new situation. Of course we're going to get upsets.
There is nothing that you would consider an upset in the current climate.
I think there are still, yes, relative upsets, but I don't know. Just nothing is going to be as surprising as it would have been in normal circumstances, I think.
Mm. Yeah, no, it's a good point. I mean,
I will be surprised if Bernarda Pera beats Serena Williams in round one, but I wouldn't be as surprised as I would have been if the season had been carrying on as normal, for example.
She almost did, Matt. She got a set off Serena Williams in round one.
The first set,
yeah.
I believe.
Were you surprised by Venus Williams beating Victoria Azarenka the way she did in round one of Lexington?
I was more surprised by the fact that Victoria Azarenka came back from that and became the force that she did, or any force. I saw that match and I thought Victoria Azarenka looks done. Yeah. And Venus Williams looks like the one who's 10 years younger. It was such a stark, jarring match, that. And then the way things turned after it was a real surprise to me.
Yeah, I mean, the surprise in that match was Venus Williams emerging with a new serve, wasn't it? And as David says, coming out of lockdown looking younger and fresher and vibrant. She was glowing that whole week. Mm. And yeah, then what followed was actually Azarenka was the one to turn it around.
Do you know something else that was a surprise to David during that period? He's doing his thinking face. Jennifer Brady.
Yeah, at that point I was still in my doubting phase, wasn't I?
Middling American on a good run of form in a pandemic.
Yeah, that's what I thought at the time.
Poor David, that was said in the safe zone of the tennis podcast WhatsApp group.
Hasn't it already been outed though?
Yes,
it has, yeah.
I think so.
What was formerly known as a sanctuary of the WhatsApp group is now out on the pod. But no, I mean, she completely won me over when we got to the US Open because she was brilliant in Lexington. Don't make it look like I didn't think she was good there. I just thought it was probably a one-off. I couldn't imagine that being repeatable at that level.
Mm. I think the thing about Brady is that she'd actually had a really good start to the year. She had so many top 10 wins clustered in January and February, but I think it's reflected in what we're talking about in that clip we've just heard. I remember feeling so unsure about whether the whole of tennis would be completely different, given that there was no crowds, no match practice. I genuinely didn't know whether the best players would still have the best results. That sounds like a ridiculous thing to say now, because I think a few months removed, one of the big takeaways is that how unchanged the sport has been. The players who are the best players are still the best players. And what we did see is so many players who started the year strongly carrying that on. And Jennifer Brady was kind of the epitome of that. She actually got even better because she spent lockdown, didn't she, in Germany with her her new coach. And yeah, she was one of the obviously big stories of the last few months, but the kind of seeds of her development were actually planted much earlier on in the year, and she was a case of how the tour, even though it had this big gap, did actually carry on with many of the players still doing well.
Mm.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
The ATP Tour made its return at the Western and Southern Open, which obviously would have been Cincinnati, but not in Cincinnati, which is obviously a combined event. Let's all take a moment to relive the weird baby from the signage. Who did the baby belong to? What was the name of the brand?
It was some insurance company, wasn't it?
Yeah, apparently it's really iconic in America. But yeah. to us, it looked like a it's a poster from a horror film.
Yeah, it looked like something that was there to just troll the players while they were going about their business.
Yeah, it felt like the sort of icing on a very weird cake. So the combined return happens at Not Cincinnati, which of course was taking place at the Billie Jean King National Tennis Center. What happens there? We have Andy Murray beating Francis Tiafoe and Alexander Zverev back-to-back. That felt like quite a big moment. I remember just loving seeing how up for that Zverev match Andy Murray was. And we know now that he's, you know, on the basis of his quotes last week, that is a very prominent result in his mind. He's obviously taking significant optimism from that match alone. We had a resurgent Milos Raonic. We had a resurgent Victoria Azarenka, as David's just discussed. And we had Naomi Osaka, who, amidst all of this, tennis's return, everything, the pandemic, has become an incredible and outspoken advocate for social justice, social change, and for the Black Lives Matter movement. And, of course, she reaches the semi-final and releases a statement to say she's not going to play her semi-final match. And that leads to the tours and the tournament backing her in that decision and announcing a pretty unprecedented pause in play, Matt.
Yeah, absolutely. It was the month of Naomi Osaka, really, wasn't it? She was, I think she's the person of the year in tennis. When you consider everything she did in that month, I just remember having this feeling of her moving tennis in a new direction in that month. It just felt so significant the way she was combining all her on-court results with all her activism, and they were separate pursuits, but they were also connected. She was very aware that the more she won, the more she'd be heard. And, you know, I'm jumping ahead a bit, but the US Open, when she, you know, she said that line about having the seven masks and hoping that people would see the seven masks, that kind of symbolized the attitude she had, I think. And yeah, it was a day when, at the Western Southern Open, it was a day where tennis, I think, did the right thing. And I think the tours were looking to do something, and Osaka provided the catalyst for it. And for her to do that in an individual sport when she didn't have support of teammates or know what the reaction would be was an incredible gesture.
Mm. And but potentially provided fuel for the formation of the PTPA. We understand that that decision of the tours and the tournaments to back Naomi Osaka with that pause in play was one of the catalysts. Obviously, the formation of the Tennis Players Union had been widely discussed before now, but certainly one of the catalysts for it happening when and where it did. I think there were other circumstances that led to it happening, a kind of captive audience situation with that bubble, the lack of presence of Roger Federer and Rafael Nadal, who were both not playing that swing and are both... have both in the past been advocates against a breakaway union. But it happened and the photo happened. And yeah, still waiting for details of what the PTPA means and what it will do. As confirmed by John Millman that we spoke to last week. But is that one of the iconic images of the year, that picture of them all in masks where you can't actually tell who's joined the PTPA because most of their faces are obscured? I don't know.
I spent way too long trying to figure out who all those players were.
It was a moment.
It was a moment, for sure.
One of many. It's not, I mean, you know, I would want to see a lot more to it than that in order to look back on it with any degree of significance, to be quite honest. But, you know, we'll see. But I suppose it did feel somewhat symptomatic of the weirdness of the year. Wasn't something that, if you'd have told me at the start of the year that there'd be 60 blokes on an outside tennis court wearing masks for a photo, all standing apart from each other. Imagine if somebody had told you
that. The creepy baby in the background.
And the US Open logo, even though the US Open had been part of the joint statement denouncing it. It was all weird.
So that happened. Victoria Azarenka won the Western and Southern Open title with Naomi Osaka putting out ahead of the final with a hamstring injury, a hamstring niggle. So sort of questions swirling around about her fitness to play the US Open. And Novak Djokovic came from behind to beat Milos Raonic in the final of the Western and Southern Open. So going into US Open, Djokovic nailed on men's favourite. And in the women's, it's kind of a bit more uncertain. Probably you'd have said Osaka, the women's favourite, but obviously the concerns over, or the uncertainty over her fitness. There were and are still portions of the tennis fraternity that viewed it as it's still Serena's to lose. And Serena played really well and she had a great tournament and she contributed to one of the best tennis days in my memory. Certainly probably the best single tennis day this year. Obviously there are fewer candidates to choose from this year, but I think that women's semifinals day is a day that stands up, pandemic or no pandemic.
Mm. Yeah, I'd say it was one of the best semi-finals days that we've had probably ever, really. I mean, and I think the context of it, given that it was in this virtually deserted stadium, almost added to it, because you have to make you feel like that when you come off commentary with an empty stadium makes it mean that you've played even better, that the tennis is even better, the drama is even better, the matches are even closer. The Brady and Osaka performances, I mean, I just don't think they could have played better, really, in their match. Azarenka and Serena Williams, I think, played brilliantly at different times in their match. There were bigger swings back and forth, but the drama was incredible. But the sheer level of Brady and Osaka just was breathtaking to me.
Mm. And it all happened on the day they were celebrating the original nine. And Billie Jean King, I believe, was in the stadium and I think said, this is the epitome of what we dreamed of. And it was the most uplifting day of the year, the probably the best tennis of the year. In fact, not probably, definitely. Yeah, and as you said, it was a night where Serena played well and didn't win. And that kind of rocks your foundations and really makes you think about where the sport is at the moment. And it just felt like a really defining night from that reason as well.
That was probably the most uplifting tennis moment of the year. I'd say the most uplifting story moment of the year was Naomi Osaka walking out onto court for that final, wearing her seventh mask, and eventually lifting the title. As much as I was a huge fan of the Victoria Azarenka story and her reaching the final, anything but an Osaka victory in that match, sort of looking back, feels wrong. It felt like that moment needed to happen and sort of had to happen. I don't believe in destiny or anything, but it is one of the sorts of moments that could make a believer out of you. And of course, the moment in her victory speech or interview where she was asked what message she was trying to send with the masks, and she instantly replies, well, what was the message you got? She's just summed it all up. She just keeps summing it all up, and just being this incredibly powerful and yet unassuming figurehead for an incredibly important movement. And I think has, you know, with some assistance from others, Coco Gauff most notably, but has completely put to bed any of the arguments about politics and sport not mixing. I mean, just shush with that now. I mean,
yeah.
It's just over, that argument. It's completely over.
I think my iconic image of the year is Naomi Osaka lying on the court after she'd won, taking her time to deliberately do that. And I just saw that as her taking everything in, you know, looking up on the stadium named after Arthur Ashe, taking in mainly the moment of winning a third Grand Slam title, a second US Open, but also everything she'd achieved that summer. And it was a moment of kind of relief, I think. And, you know, we've not seen her since then. That's kind of my lasting image of Osaka as well. And that's powerful and perfect, I think, too. Mm.
In terms of the men's event, obviously won by Dominic Thiem, his first slam, came back from two sets to love down to beat Alexander Zverev to win the title. That final set tiebreak is something that will live with me for a long time. Zverev attempting to serve out the match and serving a David Law-esque, serving several David Law-esque first and second serves. That's something that will live with me for a long time. I mean, also Catherine Whittaker-esque, to be fair, but I'm not 6 foot, 6 foot seven.
That description will live with him if somebody tells him about it.
But of course, there is one moment from the men's competition that will spring instantly to mind for pretty much everyone. The Djokovic default facing Pablo Carreño Busta in the fourth round. This was our reaction to it.
Novak Djokovic is out of the US Open. That in itself would be a big news story. The fact that he is out of the US Open, having been defaulted in the first set against Pablo Carreño Busta, having hit a line judge in the throat with a tennis ball, is just one of the biggest stories that I think I can ever remember at a Grand Slam. It was clearly accidental, but intent is irrelevant in terms of the decision to be made via the rule book, in terms of the need to default Novak Djokovic. And what followed thereafter, once the lines judge had been accompanied away, there followed a lengthy discussion between Djokovic and the referee on court. Now, it was difficult to know what was going on. We couldn't hear it completely on the TV sound. You could hear occasional words. You could kind of get the gist of bits of it. But it seems as though the decision had been made pretty instantly. I know you told me, Catherine, afterwards that Tim Hemmer and Grigor Rusedski were categoric immediately. That is a default. As soon as I saw it and realised that Djokovic had been responsible for this line judge getting hit, I knew instantly that is a default, and any other decision would have been an outrage. But there was a lengthy discussion.
The rules state that the action if it's deemed reckless or dangerous, regardless of the consequences, it's an immediate default. And Tim Henman, who has as intimate experience as it's possible to have of this situation, called it straight away. And they said, this is not a negotiation with Djokovic, as much as it might appear to be one. This is them just softening the blow and giving him time to adjust and accept. And that's a luxury that he wouldn't have had with a crowd. But yeah, there was no negotiation happening there. There was no wiggle room. There was no room for concession. There was no license for leeway in those rules. It's very, very clear. And just ask Tim Henman. He's been there.
We then waited, and I remember you saying in Prime Video's coverage, we'll bring you the press conference when it's live. And shortly afterwards, we heard that there would not be a press conference, and pictures emerged of Novak Djokovic getting into a car and driving away.
Yeah, the way to back up a rule violation is not with another rule violation, which is what failing to attend a mandatory press conference is. I know it's hard. I know it's the last thing you want to do, but it is required. It is the rules. It is part of the job. And I think everybody would have understood if he needed a whole heck of a lot of time before coming to that press conference to establish how he felt, to get over the shock. But it is part of the job. And that was a rule violation on top of a rule violation, which is not right. You know, when I said just ask Tim Henman, well, I did on air about 400 times. I mean, obviously it was sensational for our coverage that we had one of the very few people that had experienced what Djokovic had, you know, in the studio watching live. But equally, poor Tim, having to relive the worst day of his life over and over and over again. I mean, we'll come on to talk about the French Open in a moment, but watching Djokovic at the O2, I just wonder, you know, I know we talked throughout the French Open about how impressed we were with how Djokovic has bounced back from, certainly in tennis terms, from what happened there at the US Open. But I wonder, you know, he seemed shackled to me at the O2, and he seemed shackled in the French Open final. There was no, you know, during all matches at the O2 and during that French Open final against Nadal, I was waiting for the beast to come out, you know, that defiant animal that brings out the best in Novak Djokovic's tennis. And it hasn't been there, well, certainly not to the extent that it usually is when he's at his best. And I don't know if that experience at the US Open has just put the brakes on his temperament a bit. And maybe he needs those breaks not to be there to reach his peak. I don't know. It's a working theory.
Yeah, very difficult to know whether it has any effect on him lingering afterwards in terms of how he carries himself on the court. I do feel that that and that French Open final, I kind of put them together because they were both chastening in their own way. Both of them were effectively eliminators for Grand Slam titles. So obviously the French Open final was the championship match, but this felt like a championship match more or less. There was no Nadal in the field. There was no Roger Federer in the field. It was Dominic Thiem, most likely, that was going to be the one he would have to get past if they both went all the way. But, you know, Djokovic hadn't lost a match all year. It's worth remembering that the guy had been in that incredible run, and he'd just come straight back onto the tennis court. He'd won the Cincinnati tournament, played in New York. Of course, he's going to win his next Grand Slam and move to, what would it have been, 18? Just one behind Nadal. That's where he would have been. And then, who knows, you know? And that moment, that incredible moment of him hitting that ball into that line judge's throat, freakish moment, could change the course of his entire career in terms of how he's remembered historically in terms of Grand Slam titles. That could be the moment that separates him from the others.
Mm. Wow. Well, I've got ahead of myself there by mentioning that French Open final. Obviously, we had Rome beginning the day after the US Open, which was just bonkers. That was Halep's return to the tour. Obviously, she hadn't played the US Open. She'd played... where had she played? Prague. She'd played and won Prague on the clay prior to the US Open, but had elected to stay in Europe. So she won the Rome title. Djokovic won the Rome title. Seemed like, you know, an extraordinary return from him. Nadal had lost to Schwartzman, which, even though we'd said kind of nothing quite counts as a shock on tennis's return, somehow the sight of Nadal losing on clay just is a shock. So Nadal, a slight unknown quantity going into Roland Garros. Some strange people weren't picking him for the title. No need to dwell on that. But the talk, mostly, certainly from us at the start of the French Open, was about how weird it was, because it was weird. Let's remember just how weird. Well, just when you think the year 2020 has hit peak weird, the first day of Roland Garros happens and your entire definition of weird goes completely out of the window. This is the Tennis Podcast, our first Roland Garros daily that's not relived. Let's not ever relive this day of 2020. And what an incredibly bizarre day.
It is funny, isn't it? Watching the action today did genuinely make you feel cold and a bit miserable. And I mean, I don't want to be grumpy about it. I mean, we've got a Grand Slam going on, and it's great to have a Grand Slam going on, but it was jarring early on.
I've got a feeling, David, that Matt loved it. He might be our source of enthusiasm here.
Tell us about your day, Matt.
I loved the start of the day. I thought it was hilarious when they all walked out wearing their tracksuits and it was raining and it was 40-mile-an-hour winds.
Azarenka was in a puffer jacket.
I mean, they looked more like Arctic explorers than tennis players. It was absolutely wonderful, I thought,
for about an hour.
I didn't focus on a single shot that was hit for about an hour. I was just sort of jumping from court to court to see what everyone was wearing. And there was and there was one stage where the only two players who didn't have extra layers on were Dan Evans from Solihull and Emil Ruusuvuori from Finland. And I thought that sort of summed it up. Everyone else was layered and had tracksuits sensibly, I thought. But
I saw tennis played in a gilet today.
Was it a gilet?
Well, I mean, I thought it looked like a photographer's vest.
That's a good description. What Venus Williams Queens, was wearing.
But I think it was more quilted than that to provide much needed insulation.
Warmth, yes. For an hour or so, I couldn't really see the ball on many of the courts because the cameras just sort of had drops of rain on them. Yet, I kind of loved it. It was kind of the chaos that I was hoping for. But I must say, as the day wore on, I was kind of hoping for some better tennis. And I think the wind and the conditions did make it very, very difficult for them.
So I know you're all tuning in to the day 4 French Open tennis podcast, wondering, well, how could it get any weirder today? And the answer that you're probably not expecting was a sonic boom. That is how the French Open got weirder. On day 4, an actual sonic boom that brought Roland Garros and the rest of Paris to a very eerie, foreboding standstill. And I'm making light of it now that we all know it was a sonic boom, but there was a fighter jet breaking the sound barrier, and it made a sound that was literally heard over the whole of Paris. But obviously there were some very, very eerie moments there when people were fearing the worst about what it might have been. But yeah, an actual sonic boom. I don't think that's anything we've ever covered in a tennis podcast before. Confirmed.
So far, yeah. We're one and out so far with sonic booms. Well, it was a funny old few days, wasn't it? I mean, it brightened up as the tournament went along, but goodness me, those first half dozen days.
And that sonic boom was within the same hour that Serena Williams withdrew from the tournament before
yes.
her second round match, I think. It was difficult to believe that all these things were happening so close to each other on that morning.
And of course, when the sun sort of did come out in the second week, which we'd all been desperately hoping for throughout the miserable first week, it turned out to be a disaster because of the shadow created by the new Philippe Chatrier roof. Apparently that won't be such a problem when Roland Garros is staged at its normal intended time in early spring, but with the sun lying where it was, basically the sort of tennis was unwatchable at certain times of the day on Philippe Chatrier. So lots of elements of weird. What wasn't weird was Nadal winning the title. 13 Roland Garros titles, ridiculous. What was weird at the time, certainly doesn't seem it now that we're all well acquainted with her tennis, but I think it's fair to say that Iga Świątek winning the women's title would perhaps have been considered weird a few months ago.
For sure. I mean, she was not really a contender before the tournament, and then she was playing really nicely through the first few rounds, but she had Halep in the fourth round, and everyone, all of us, were talking about how great Halep was looking, and that just felt like such a roadblock for her. And then she thrashed Halep. And then what made it even more impressive was that once she'd done that, wasn't she immediately made the favourite for the title? And yet she didn't waver. There was never any sense of panic or the occasion getting to her at all. And she just sort of continued her path of destruction through every single match. You know, I was looking up the fewest games ever lost en route to a French Open final. And, you know, she was very much in the mix in terms of that record. It was a staggeringly good performance, and she seemed to mature that fortnight. I mean, I think we knew she was capable of creative, exciting tennis, but I don't think anyone was anticipating the way it would all come together for her and just feel so right that she would kind of be the French Open champion by the end of it.
Mm. She's going to win more slams, isn't she? She's not going to be an Ostapenko.
I'd be very surprised if there's not a lot in her future. Just certainly game-wise. I mean, I don't know about the technicalities, whether there are things that can go wrong. People sometimes talk about the forehand being, I think, a late take-back and delivery on the shot. But it doesn't seem to go wrong to me, and it's devastating. And she's just such an instinctive player. Oh, I can't wait to see tennis resume, really, with all the names that we've just described over the last half an hour.
Mm. Obviously, we did have tennis after the French Open. We had two events in Cologne with dogs.
And we had a Strava.
We had a Strava.
With three exclamation marks in a Strava.
We learned where Nur Sultan is.
Where is it again?
Astana. Astana is now called Nur Sultan.
Which Where's is Astana?
Azerbaijan.
Kazakhstan.
Oh, balls. We failed to learn where Nur Sultan is.
We?
Well, you had to ask.
I just wanted to hear you say Azerbaijan.
Great. Well, I've definitely learned now. Public humiliation is definitely the best way to learn. Would it be happy? We had St. Petersburg, Antwerp, Vienna, the Paris Masters went ahead. Linz was the final event on the WTA Tour. And of course, we had the ATP Finals. No WTA Finals, which is a desperate shame. And Daniil Medvedev ending the year with the metronomic winning of titles. Which I'm sure there'll be more of in the future. And yeah, we don't know anything about the future, do we? Because as we record this, we don't know when tennis will resume.
No. I mean, as things stand, the latest reports are that it'll be a 3-week delayed Australian Open that starts on the 8th of February with a couple of weeks of quarantine in which players can practice. As you know, it's it sounds like they're really being put through it, Tennis Australia, right now by the government, and understandably so. We've had quite a lot of correspondence from listeners in Australia that say, look, you know, we love tennis. We love tennis. We would love the Australian Open to happen and to be a massive success. But we also know what it has taken to get this country and this state of Victoria to zero cases of coronavirus every day for about 3 weeks. And we are now, having come through that awful few months, living relatively normally, and we do not want anything to get in the way of that. And I mean, I really can understand that. And they've got to strike the balance. And it's a huge diplomatic effort for Tennis Australia to convince the authorities that they are going to do it safely without compromising this huge public health effort.
Yeah, in the 24 hours up to December 1st, 2020, the state of Victoria had 6,874 coronavirus tests performed, of which there were no positive cases, no lives lost, no active cases, and zero cases with unknown source. And they've sacrificed tremendously to achieve those pretty extraordinary numbers. And it is entirely understandable that nobody wants to put that into jeopardy for the sake of anything, really. As challenging as it is that the Australian summer is shrouded in uncertainty, it's entirely understandable. Hey, John Millman will be out of quarantine by now, won't he?
Yeah, he's having what was that breakfast that he wants to have with his halloumi on
avocado on toast. Yeah, a classic Brizzy breakfast.
Halloumi on the side.
My parents miss those. They used to live in Brisbane, and Brisbane does good. I mean, Australia in general, but Brisbane really does do a good breakfast.
Yeah. Hope you're enjoying it, John.
Riverbend Cafe in Bulimba. That's where I'd be if I were him. Anyway, yeah, enjoy, John. That's it for reliving this year. Let's put 2020 to bed.
Yeah, let's just leave it there. No more reliving. Even I draw the line at reliving that thing again.
No more reliving. Let's look ahead to 2021, when we will be doing more podcasts. We certainly will if we get the 5 more required percent of our funding target. A reminder that if you'd like to contribute, please do. We will use every penny to make this podcast as good as it can possibly be for 2021. So thank you, everybody that's contributed so far. We're very excited about all the awards categories and all the pets that I'm going to get to know over the next few months. And we can't wait to do more of these podcasts. We're doing one on Monday, aren't we? What are we doing on Monday, Matt?
Unfortunately, it's more looking back on 2020. we're doing our awards for the year. We've got our live show this weekend on Zoom with some of our Kickstarter backers, our predictions level backers from last year. And we're going to be reflecting on that and revealing what the awards and nominations were. So, yes, unfortunately, one more look back on 2020 and then we can properly draw a line under it.
I went too soon on putting things to bed, as I so often do. So join us on Monday for our next tennis podcast. Check out our Kickstarter if you'd like. Check out the Instagram Q&A that I did yesterday. Oh, that's my alarm going off. That's my alarm going off to check the Kickstarter at the 48-hour mark. My alarm is a Taylor Swift song. Okay, think I humiliated myself enough for today. We'll see you on Monday.
One-800-Flowers.com is more than your birthday, anniversary, or just because gift-giving destination. We put our hearts into everything we do to help you celebrate all life's special occasions with friends and family. From our farmers and bakers, florists and makers, everything from 1-800-Flowers is made with love every step of the way, because we know that nothing is more important than delivering a smile. To learn more, visit 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.
That's 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.